Hello and welcome back to the Retro Asylum. My name's Dean Swain and with me tonight is the rest of the team, Mads, Matt, Steve and Chris. Now guys, it's been a turbulent time for us recently. I'm just going to read out a statement which we had to publish a few days ago, which was not something we was expecting to have to do, but so bear with me. We have had to remove certain episodes from our back catalogue as we were recently made aware of a former host's involvement in a serious crime and subsequent police investigation. The person in question is now awaiting sentencing. Retro Asylum would like to state that we are utterly appalled by the former host's crimes, and even though this person hasn't been on the show for many years, we as a collective felt it in the public's interest to remove all episodes and artworks featuring said host. And that is from myself, Mads, Matt, Steve and Chris. So, yeah, it's been a strange time. And I just want to thank all of our listeners and the retro gaming community in general, because the majority of people have given us a lot of support over this. You know, it's a very difficult situation to have to handle. When I found out, my jaw hit the floor. It's been a lot to take in and it's been a lot to deal with. You know, our immediate thought was we've got to get rid of all the episodes. Well, our immediate thought was disgust, you know, Then it was, right, the show. We've got to kill those episodes. We don't want to listen to them again. We don't want our listeners to listen to those again. So, yeah, that is it, really. It's been a difficult time. But as I say, I just want to thank everyone out there who's given us support. And you guys are amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Just a second what you're saying there, Dean. I think to reiterate, and we said it in a statement, we're all absolutely horrified to find out what has gone on, and we're not going to go into details because we don't want to be further into details about what's gone on or anything like that, but needless to say, we are absolutely appalled by it. But the response we have had from our community has been amazing, because there was a minute there where we thought, well, we're done, this is the end. There was a serious conversation about whether we could even carry on. And we did have some sleepless nights talking about that and what to do next. And, you know, we decided on that statement and we were quite overwhelmed by the response we got from our community.
Absolutely.
The people on Discord, people on Facebook, people on Twitter. Like, majority of them, barring a couple of idiots, were really, really super positive, super supportive, really had our backs, and shows what a great community we've got. And I think probably one of the other things to say is, though, when you're hosting a podcast and we're all friends, but you don't really know who these people are.
The thing really, is, you know, Steve, this could be in any situation. You work with people, you think you know them. And it could, you know, unfortunately, you hear things with family members, not my family, I just want to put out, but you know, there's been people who you find that, you know, these people are related to people, and this could have been any situation. It's got me big time, because obviously, you know, me and said person, we spent quite a bit of time putting this show together, you know, and yeah, you're right. It just goes to show you don't know anyone really. So,
especially in this instance, because, you know, I count you all as my mates. Do not get me wrong. 100% I've spent great time with you guys and that, but I didn't grow up with you. I don't live in your house. I don't know what you get up to. And so you don't ever really know anything, you know, and that's the point.
This is what I mean. If you're working with someone or even friends from school or something, you don't know what goes on behind closed doors.
But true. I think even
what
if
goes on in people's minds,
and even if you're behind those closed doors, you know, this guy's got a wife, he's got a child, and one can only assume that they didn't know what was going on. Yeah. So if they didn't know, how was anybody else supposed to know?
And to say that, you know, you touched on it there, Chris, that there's there's victims here, and us having to take down some content is minor compared to what the victims, should they know what's going on, have been through. And you know, like you say, a wife and child will be sat there right now talking about their futures, and their futures are grim, frankly, thanks to this individual's actions. Correct. Whereas, you know, we can move on, we can get on with the show and produce some more content, whereas they have a life of this. So just putting that in context, you know, it is really disappointing we've had to remove so much, because there's some great shows there, but what, none of us can listen to them with the same ears anymore. And I'm sure that's the case for every single listener as well.
Yeah.
And just to sort of maybe draw a line under it, but we have discussed our next steps as well. And our next steps are, thanks to our support of our community and stuff, is that we pick the ball back up. We start putting our shows back out like we always have. We carry on, and certain episodes that we've lost, we will look back into doing new versions of. 8-Bit Wars is one that got mentioned quite a lot. Hopefully we'll do some of that again, and we'll recapture that stuff, new versions. And any big episodes where we could potentially edit said person out because it's their own segment, then we may well look to try and do that as well, and then repost the episodes without that person. So, you know, not all is lost, but as a show, we are drawing a line under it, separating ourselves from it, and we're going to move forward, and hopefully thanks to the support of our community, crack on. Thank you to them for giving us that.
Indeed.
Support, because it could have ended up with being over, and it hasn't. So,
yeah, cool. Right, well, that's where I'm going to draw a line under it.
Yep.
That's done. Let's move forward. Okay, so this is episode 284.
We're
still doing numbers.
Yeah.
For what they're worth. Right, okay, so this episode, and we had this planned before all the other stuff happens. Unfortunately, David Wald, who was a co-founder of Ocean Software, passed away recently. So it was me and Steve originally just going to do this episode. We thought it'd be nice to just have a look back at some of our favourite Ocean games. So that's what this episode is going to be about. But before we get into all of that, have you guys got any news?
I would quickly, very quickly, and I know I keep talking, so I'll shut up. I just want to quickly say, I was sent Zeta Wing by Bitmapsoft, and I've been having a quick play at that over the last couple of weeks. He sent me a boxed cartridge edition, and it's brilliant. And I know we said we'd support this, you know, hopefully support this guy, but we wouldn't tell you anything was good if it wasn't. But I've had a look at what he sent us over. He sent us this box version of Zeta Wing. It's absolutely brilliant. The box is lovely. It's really old school, lovely design, really quality materials. It's got instruction booklet inside with all the story of the game and how they made it and picture the levels and how you get through them. And also, very, very sneakily, they've hidden in there a cheat code to unlock another Sarah Jane Avery game. They've also included a secret code in there to unlock Neutron.
As if he knew it, Steve.
As if I knew it. But I worked it out. He told me, have a look and see if you can work it out through the manual. And I looked through the manual and eventually worked it out and unlocked Neutron. So two for one in this boxed
cartridge.
So
that's a bit of a bargain as well.
It is. And the last thing I'd like to say on it is, at some point, maybe we can have a little bit of a competition or something. And maybe one of our listeners could win this thing if Dean's willing to pay for the postage.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, that's my news. I've been doing that, played with that. Great. Check it out, and you can also check it out on bitmapsoft.co.uk or .com. Dean.
.co.uk.
.co.uk.
Brilliant. What format is it on, Steve?
That's
in the
C64.
C64 cartridge. Yeah.
And what media?
The best
cartridge.
8-bit format, cartridge. Of course.
Cartridge. Yeah, it's really good. It's really nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
So When do you also get a digital version of the game as well?
You may do. I don't know, because
I think you
plug
do
the
when
cartridge
you,
in. You probably
I think
do.
You buy
yeah.
them from the store. I think you get a CRT file as well.
Mm. Yeah, both. You probably do. You have to double check. But obviously, I just played the cartridge because I got it and it was great. Yeah, on the real hardware. But
nice.
But yeah, really, really nice gear from those guys. So yeah, I'm happy to report it was great, and maybe
well
someone can
nice.
Win it.
It is well nice getting a new game for a retro platform that's boxed. I got Solus, and this must be nearly 10 years ago now, the original Solus. And it came in a big box like that. I got a map of the game, there were some extra bits in there, stickers and all sorts, and a tape, and it was fantastic. And I genuinely, you know, loaded it up on the real hardware. Fantastic. It was not the greatest game when you look back on it. It was okay. It's really good, but it's a little bit boring. I think they've addressed some of the issues in Solus too. But yeah, fantastic. I remember getting it at work and opening it up and just going to everyone, look, brand new 664 game. No one gave a toss. But I was as happy as Larry.
Yeah. There's something lovely about that tangible thing. And it's like, it took me back as well, even though it's new. It took me back opening it up and pulling the cartridge out and seeing all the instructions and everything really nicely done, because you get nothing in boxes anymore with games. Rubbish.
Yeah.
Well, it's just DVD boxes, aren't they? Or whatever. I don't know what. Well, you don't get boxes these days. It's all digital.
Oh, look at this one.
Look at that.
It was a Vectrex game that I bought.
Look at that. That's a proper video case.
That's
isn't
a video case, yeah.
Sweet.
That's mammoth. And that came with full colour instructions and an overlay and stuff. So
that box, the size of that box reminds me of, I think it was Graphical Adventure Creator on the Speccy.
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
in that size. With about five tapes in it.
That's right, yeah.
Beautiful.
It is nice though, isn't it, to have something physical every now and then. It ain't often I get one, but yeah, it's just a couple of years old. But yeah, my bit of news is the Vectrex is it's got a problem.
The laser's gone.
No, it's
Millennium bug.
Switch it on and the games start themselves and the characters start moving. And it turns out it's actually the AY chip is becoming defective and it causes a problem. So
how do you know?
I asked people in the know.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
Is this a common thing then with what's,
apparently,
what's the plural of Vectrex? Vectrices. Vectrex.
Yeah.
Let's go with that one.
I don't know. But apparently replacing the AY chip in it is the cure. Now I haven't opened this Vectrex up. I'm hoping it isn't soldered in. Some of them are just in sockets. Yeah.
Because ironically, it's quite an easy chip to get hold of.
It is, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, that's my watch. Shut up.
your watch isn't retro, Dean, is it? Talks to you.
I did have Pong on it for a little while. But...
Nice. I'll tell you what, the plural of Vectrex soon will just be rare. That's all it is.
Expensive.
Dying, yeah.
Well, Dean's got you've got two of them, Dean, so you can nick the AY chip out of the other one.
No, I haven't. I sold one ages ago because one was the better one out of the two at the time. But yeah.
Didn't offer it to us, mate. Did you?
No, sorry.
When they were £80 and I turned them down. I mean, it's just beggars belief, isn't it?
I know.
Really mad. Really mad. I've got a bit of news. So A500 Minis had the first official firmware update, which is added in ADF support, easy joystick switching during gameplay, the ability to actually use their own joystick on it, where the fire buttons were swapped around on the original firmware. Yep. Unfortunately, the good old zip stick still doesn't work. The odd game works properly. Otherwise, it's still the wrong fire button. So I'm hoping that comes down the line. But it's still nice. And there's some other bits and pieces I can't quite remember. Something about shrinking and expanding the screen during a game.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nice to see they're updating it. And there's been loads of kind of soft mods for it since then. It's built a real big community up for it, where RetroArch can get RetroArch on it now, so it can do everything up to 16-bit pretty slickly if you want to do that. I don't want to do
PS1
that.
PS1 goes up to PS1. And pretty well as well.
PS1. Oh, 32X as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I saw it doing PS1 at 60 frames a second, so it's pretty tidy. Impressive, isn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's nice to see. And all these little soft mods, it's just a nice little community, actually.
Yeah.
It's coming on.
Have you guys seen the... sorry, Mads, I'll jump in. Have you guys seen the dates or two potential dates have been announced for Chris Wilkins' Crash show later this year?
Yes, late November, isn't it?
So it's either going to be the 19th or the 26th of November. And it looks like, although I have heard mumblings about potentially a revival as well, but this just feels like
This is revival. They're involved. Craig's involved with this. So, obviously it's going to be focused on the Spectrum.
Yeah, is it though? I mean, I think it's meant to be, but then you've got the Fusion section, which has everything else. So.
Multi-format, yeah, so...
But who cares? I mean, it's...
Exactly. If I can get along, then I'll be there.
It's been almost 3 years since the last revival. Well, is it 2 years? 2 years, hasn't it, since the last revival?
Yeah.
Right at the start of COVID.
Who's up for it?
I'd be well for it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Matt, can we get you guys? Or are you going to?
You may not get me.
Maybe. We'll see. Well, wait and
that's
see.
The thing I wanted to say as well. In the evening, and I only seen this on Facebook earlier today, but in the evening, apparently, there's going to be a first showing of Nicola and Mr. Caulfield's, what's his name?
Robert Key Wonder.
Anthony. Nicola and Anthony Caulfield's new Specky film is going to be shown in the evening, ticketed only.
Robert Key Wonder.
We can all have a beer, the Rubber Key Wonder. We can all have a beer, sit round, watch the watch the film. That'll be good.
We'll get VIPs for that, don't we?
I couldn't care less as long as we're there. Well, if VIP sits at the front.
Yeah. Well, we have actually been invited to take part, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. We'll have a discussion about that. I mean,
well, maybe we could have a high score competition over that weekend, and Steve, you can give away your. And then Dean can save his postage, can't he?
Well, there you go. Or maybe we can go down
I've
and do a
podcast. I've still got your C64 here, Chris.
Well,
I don't want to stick that in a post.
Well, hopefully I'll get that before November, but if not, there you go.
Hopefully.
To date.
Yeah. Or maybe we can go and record a podcast there or something.
Yeah, it'd be good.
Yeah.
Right, Mads, any news?
Yeah, I do have some news. And before Chris rudely interrupted me, I was about to say the A500 Mini, Paul the Driss Driscoll actually sent me some configuration files, some UAE configuration files that you can use to load actual CD32 images from the BIN Q files.
Oh, so
instead of having a VHD load package, you can actually load the entire CD with the right soundtrack and everything. And
that's nice.
It even starts up with the original kickstart run with the CD32 image.
Yeah, yeah.
The disc flying
spread
in.
Spread the love, Mads. Yeah, spread the love, you know. Yeah. Send them
that's
out.
The best thing about the CD32. Was that your jingle at the beginning?
Not sure, man. But it does load the right CD32 kickstart ROM and even the extended ROM if you need that, and and loads the disk images, and I think it's WAV or MP3 files, or maybe it's one of the two. I'm not sure, but just been looking at that Paul sent me, and it looks really, really nice. I just had a play at Alpha Chicken just to listen to that soundtrack, for example, and it seems to run perfectly.
Nice.
Of course, some of the games will need tweaking of the UAE settings, but you can actually play full CD32 games there. I like that.
Nice. I like
that's
that.
That's without hacking anything. I mean, you don't need to install RetroArch or anything. It's just on the built-in emulator.
Cool.
And in other news, for listeners that also listen to the video game newsroom Time Machine, Carl has gotten himself a new co-host, and it's our very own Wouther or Wido from the Discord channel, and he's doing really well. So
nice,
go over there and check out their latest two episodes where he's co-hosting with Carl. That's really good.
That's the guy that Stephen Dean called Wido Bellox Chicken. Isn't it?
Yes, exactly. And I guess that's why he doesn't support us anymore. I can understand that, definitely. Yeah. But no, he's a good guy. And he's hosting with Carl these days.
Cool. Good luck. Right. Nice.
Right then. Ocean Software. What's your favourites, boys?
Ooh.
Chase HQ C64, obviously. Come on.
Yeah. Of course. For me, Ocean, I mean, there's so many favourites. But for me, just looking at that Ocean logo, it's arcade conversions on my Amiga. That's the first thing that pops into my mind. I mean, playing New Zealand Story and Rainbow Island and Parasol Stars and all sorts. It's just they published some really, really good arcade conversions.
Were they seen as a popular publisher over in Denmark? Or?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. It was a sign of quality, and I know some of them. I've been playing, for example, Batman the Movie today, which is one of the games that me and my mates used to play a lot. My mate Morden loved this game.
Was that the
game.
Amiga version?
Yeah, the Amiga playing. Version. What is it, 89, Batman the Movie.
Yeah.
You start in the, Ajax chemical plant or something like that, and you move on to the next level, which is in the car. I think you played it for an episode once, didn't you, Steve?
Yeah, Steve played it, yeah.
Yeah,
that car,
yeah.
The driving section still got that lovely mechanic where you whip onto the lamppost.
Straight around the corner.
Yeah. And that lamppost sound gets me every time. It's
I love the soundtrack in that game as well.
You know what? It's one of the games that gives me more nostalgia than anything else, and I think it's probably because it's when... Because it come with the Amiga. Was that in the FA-18 Interceptor pack?
Yeah, I got that. That was the pack I had, yeah.
Yeah, so my brother got that, and that's kind of like my first memories of the Amiga. So it'd have been that and FA-18 would have been the two games played the most in that pack. And yeah, that the soundtrack in the platforming level is it's just got those classic old Amiga samples as well.
Yeah. And it's a great-looking game. But I have to say, playing it today on the Mister, it's slow. It's like moving through molasses, and I didn't remember it being that slow actually to play the platforming levels. But it's still a good game, and still I would still pick up and play today. But yeah, we've been spoiled by better platformers these days, haven't we?
Yeah.
My recollection of it when I did it for that playthrough thing that we did was initially loving it, going back and playing it again. This is great. Then realizing just how long and drawn out those car sections are, like stupidly hard.
Really?
And the Batwing one. Yeah, you go on for absolutely.
Oh, yeah, the Batwing, that was tough.
I actually prefer the 8-bit versions of the driving sections. I know they look lovely on the Amiga.
Yeah.
But I think it kind of... Does it play better?
On and on. No.
I don't know. It's...
Stupidly hard.
Batman was a good game, but it wasn't as good as the Spectrum version of RoboCop. So
yeah,
Ocean for me is pure nostalgia. Just pure nostalgia. Like that logo is from, you know, when I think back to playing the 8-bits and the 16-bits when I was a kid.
Nice. Matt is holding Ocean book up, and so is Chris now. Nice.
There you are. We're all holding up the same Ocean book, the history.
Matt was yours.
Great book, by the way. Shout out to Chris Wilkins, but great book, Ocean, the history.
Yeah.
But that logo, just pure nostalgia. You know, and if you would have said to me, I reckon when I got to about 25-ish, if you'd have said to me, Chris, name me one developer publisher from when you were a kid, who will it be? Ocean just would have rolled off my tongue. And now I think, now that we have a bit of a deeper appreciation for the old stuff, I think we know that not all of the games were great. Of course they weren't. They threw out a lot of games. Mm. There was still enough quality there across the board, which, you know, we're going to talk in a little bit more detail about some of our favourites. But I think, as Matt just said, almost a guarantee of quality, similar to, you know, Nintendo stuff. If it came from Nintendo, you knew quality. If it came from Ocean, you would expect quality.
For me, there's one thing, and that is Ocean Loader Music 1.
Oh.
You know, Martin Galway's. I know Matthew Cannon and Jonathan Dunn did theirs as well, but that Ocean Loader 1, and I remember it specifically on Rambo. It was probably the first game I played on the C64 with Rambo, and that music utterly blew me away.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never heard anything like it. And it, you know, even to this day, it's goosebump worthy, isn't it? Because it's that sound, it's that era of the C64. Plus, it was the C64 just doing what it does best.
Yeah.
And that was the sit chip. Don't get me wrong, I do like the later Ocean Loaders. I think they all have their time. And actually, it became a thing, didn't it? The whole Ocean Loader concept became a thing, you know, to get asked to do that. So Jonathan Dunn and Matthew Cannon. Later interviews, you've seen how sort of honoured they were to try and live up to Martin Galway's. Because wasn't the second one a remix of Martin Galway's by Matthew Cannon, I think, or Jonathan Dunn, one of the two.
Something like that, yeah.
And then there was an original new Ocean Loader, and they were just brilliant. I think it was Ocean Loader 4 as well.
But, I was just trying to find out how many they did. I know there was at least 4, wasn't there?
There was at least 4.
4 or 5.
You know, so I'm staying quiet, because there's a Spectrum guy. Whoosh! We didn't have that...
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because the AY chip, obviously you couldn't do it when loading, because that was the C64 doing something quite unique, wasn't it?
The only game I ever saw doing anything was, because you guys on the C64, you had games like Space Invaders.
Invader Load, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Blade by Players Software Joe Blade 2, I think it was, had a Pac-Man game playable while that game was loading, and that was the only time I ever saw anything like that on the Spectrum. But no nice music or nothing too flashy, you know. We got our loading screen, and a lot of the Ocean loading screens, especially the ones by David Thorpe, that's all he'd done was loading screens.
Yeah.
Some of them were great, really decent, but he wasn't exclusive to Ocean. He'd done some work for US Gold as well.
You know what? You're just talking about loading screens and then loading music and Invader Load. You forget how integral those things were in the game. You know, the loading screen was a thing as well, wasn't it? And especially on the Spectrum, where you saw it drawing it bit by bit sometimes. And if it wasn't a hyperload, it drew it really slowly.
Mm.
But that was part of it.
That was all part of it. You know, it's the anticipation. Mm. You'd read your instructions or a magazine review while the game was loading. And then, you know, you're watching the timer go down.
Yeah, the speed lock. And then copy
tape
protection.
Loading error.
Speed lock.
Damn, it's crashed. I'll have to try it again.
I
remember it was like when I'd switched over from the Atari 800 XL to the C64.
Yeah,
and I got, good, I think good move. It was a good move, but the Atari's loader is absolutely terrible.
It's very slow, yeah, isn't it?
It's really, really slow, and it just beeps like a horrible...
Yeah, beep load.
It's 10 minutes. It's absolutely horrible. And then I got the Commodore 64, and I think it was Grizo, and I think it was out that by Ocean. I think it was by Ocean.
Imagine, wasn't it? No, it was actually on the Ocean label.
I'm sure it was on Ocean.
It's weird because Imagine Software after they went out of business, got bought by Ocean anyway.
Yeah, so the back catalogue.
Yeah.
But a lot of arcade conversions
were on the Imagine label. Anyway, go on, Steve.
Yeah, I just remember that one of the first games I'd loaded up, and it was Grizo, and it was just and I just went, oh, this is great. Not only am I getting, there it is, Grizo's holding it up, lovely. Matt is holding it up even. Not only was there colours going up and down the sides of the screen now, and it's all flashing like mad, and there's music playing, and there's screen loaded. And I was just like, I have like elevated my gaming experience here. I have gone from a milk float to a Ferrari. good times.
I think we also have to mention the artwork on the covers as well.
Bob Wakelin's
amazing, incredible. I know we've mentioned that many, many times on this show before, but it deserves another mention.
Obviously, back then, it was screenshots and the cover art, wasn't it? That's what appealed to you. That's what grabbed your attention. And that's where I think Ocean excelled from everyone else. Bob Wakelin's artwork was amazing, and it really stood out.
Well, you've just got to look back on some of the interviews you've seen since, and a lot of companies like farmed out the artwork on the cover to local artists.
Yeah.
You know, they just pick someone in the Yellow Pages, for instance, someone. Whereas you've got in-house artists, well, they might not have been actually working in-house, but a common set of artists, or artist in this case. So you'd have this common kind of quality coming out of it. You think of Ocean, Ultimate Play the Game, companies like that, you knew it was one of their games from the covers.
They elevated everything, didn't they? They took it all from like this. Initially, I think it was like you could write in at a magazine, tear off the little slip or phone a number up to get the postal order of a game. And it suddenly, it started to get elevated and they took it to that next level. I always remember like seeing Ocean Games and seeing that logo in magazines. And in my head, you know, I work in a nice office now with all this ridiculous nonsense. That's why I imagined Ocean like would be like when I was a kid. In my head, it was like, this place must be like going to the future. It's Ocean. They're the biggest, the best. So
In reality, it was a Quaker ass.
Yeah, these little pokey rooms with people in.
Yeah,
doing stuff. But it gives the impression of taking it up to that next level, like it was a film company.
Yeah,
it still was though, because there was very few companies like that actually had a full-on building with developers in it all the time.
And, you know, this episode was put together simply because of David Ward's legacy. And that guy, he changed UK video gaming. You know, by going after those licenses, he beat a lot of people to that a few years in advance, really, you know. And it just made a big difference. See, I think their first game was called Kong, which was obviously based on Donkey Kong. That's their first Spectrum release anyway, and it wasn't a great game, but after that they started going for licenses, you know, Wimpy and stuff like that.
Hunchback, one of the early arcade conversions.
So, you know, it was ahead of their time, even in the early days.
You know, the funny thing I didn't realise about David Ward and John Woods is that they were businessmen prior to forming Spectrum Games, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was from the rag trade originally.
They had a clothes business. They were importing clothes from the Middle East and flogging them down there. Yeah, almost like a kind of Doughboy and Rodney kind of.
Scousers. I think they're both Scousers.
They were from the Wirral, West Kirby they were from.
Oh, the Wirral, okay. So Wolves then.
Not quite.
A pair of Wolves. But I remember, go on.
Well, they didn't want to start up in Liverpool because at that time, obviously, you had Bugbyte and you had Software Projects.
And Imagine.
So that's why they went to Manchester, which at the time wasn't as wasn't as kind of burgeoning with developers and publishers as there was in Liverpool. So that's why they formed Ocean in Manchester rather than Liverpool.
Yeah. And I'm glad that they did.
Yeah.
Although I want to pull Chris up maybe a little bit on something he said before about the seal of approval from Nintendo being an equivalent with Ocean. I've watched Kim Justice's video.
Yeah.
Of nearly every single game, and there's a lot of crap in there.
Knight Rider,
Transformers, Highlander.
That's why I qualified what I said to Nintendo gave you a guarantee of quality. Ocean gave you an expectation of quality.
Yeah, nice.
It didn't always live up to it.
I do think, and I said this just before we started recording, I think once Gary Bracey joins, that's when the production levels went up a lot. Especially their in-house teams, you know?
You know, what were you saying there? So when I was thinking about this podcast, I think they are a tale of three halves. You've got the quick win licenses just to get a license and throw out a game. Now, it might have been good on one platform and absolutely shocking on the others, but something like Knight Rider, and you just mentioned Transformers there as well.
Highlander.
Terrible.
They were awful.
And that's because they're a business and they just wanted money in the coffers, basically.
Yeah, then but they were farming out a lot of their... They did have in-house programmers, but a lot of the bigger games, such as Knight Rider, Highlander, they were outsourced to different developers.
Denton Designs, didn't he, and a couple of others?
Denton Designs done a few of their things.
Special effects.
They were good, though, the Denton Designs.
Yeah, they didn't do them ones.
Yeah, Denton and Special Effects were actually two of the better software developers.
Very good. But you've got that side to Ocean, which is the business side, and then you've got the kind of mediocre ones where they just did an all right job, right through to the really good ones. That's what I mean. They've got such a spectrum, a wide range. Where you look at someone like US Gold, which in general we don't look back on so fondly.
No,
there's the odd good game, but mainly you refer to them as getting a license, banging a game out.
Well, US Gold were more of just the publisher.
Yeah.
They didn't have their own in-house team. But both firms are actually... US Gold had stakes in Ocean in the early days as well, which is quite interesting.
Yeah. There's a lot of crossover between the two companies, isn't there?
Yeah.
But in terms of licenses gone for, and ownership as well. Yeah. Do you know the other thing that strikes me? And there's a picture in this Ocean history book. Just how young they were. Like, David Ward and John Woods, they've been around. But if you look at the in-house people they have working with them, have a look at a picture from Ocean back in the day.
You read about it in interviews, don't you, with developers, and you know they were 15, 16, and they were getting driven up there by their mums and dads to sign a contract for a game.
Yeah.
And you know, they come away with, I don't know, a contract and £200, and to them it was fantastic because I'm a 15, 16 year old with £200.
But even
they
like
seem to attract decent coders though.
Yeah.
In house, I think. As a Speccy owner, you know, you had Joffa Smith, Mike Lamb, obviously Jim Bagley with Special Effects, but, you know, that's three of the best programmers on the system.
Matthew Cannon tells the story, doesn't he, of how he, I've heard him on various podcasts saying how when he was, you know, his mum took him to the interview, like you just said, Matt, and he walked in, it was just a room full of kids. And you know, we criticise some of the games that they produced back in the early days, They were literally children doing this stuff. I mean, incredibly talented.
Yeah, I've spoken to Simon Butler a couple of times about this because he was a fair bit older than the rest of them. I think he had a good 10 years on them, and he said like a lot of them used to just drive him mad because it was like going to school and being the teacher. It's like, stop picking your nose. What have you just wiped on your leg? Why have you flicked that over there? Turn that off. It's I felt for him a little bit when he was telling me about that.
And you see this, so you're talking about it being sort of glass ivory house, Steve, and you see the photos of it, and they called it the dungeon, wasn't it? The downstairs dungeon. Smoky atmosphere, you know, so you've got people smoking in front of 16-year-old kids, and, you know, it's just a grimy, horrible place. But do you know what? I bet the atmosphere was something else.
Oh, what a time it
must have
been.
You've only got to listen to most of the interviews, and everyone's just going, you know, Martin Galway in his own office with all the synthesizers and stuff in it. And if you happen to land upon that office as a newbie, you'd just be in awe of it.
Yeah.
And then you'd have arcade machines in the corner that they're currently working on a conversion for. It must have been just a treasure trove of beauty for people like us. If you'd put us in there as a 15, 16-year-old, you'd not worried about the smog. You'd have just walked through and gone, this is amazing. And all that development kit there as well. It'd have been something else.
But they were creating an industry themselves. There was no industry in the early 80s. They were one of the publishers and developers that created the industry. So,
I mean, pioneers.
They went from their bedrooms into the dungeon. And I suspect if that same ethos carried them through, probably until, you know, the mid 90s when they were acquired, and the world really changed, didn't it, in the mid 90s with, you know, the advent of Sony and whatnot.
Yeah. And this is kind of a sad thing to think, but they wouldn't have really fitted beyond the 90s. I can't see Ocean really, because they were just 8-bit, 16-bit pioneers.
Yeah, they were too small.
Some of the later 16-bit titles, the quality started to go down.
Yeah, they couldn't keep up. They couldn't keep up with the developers that had really bettered themselves in and started in 16-bit and beyond, who were really good at it. They were trying to, they were chasing.
Where did they end up? So who bought them? Because they were still
around. Infograms, yeah. Them out.
Yeah.
And didn't they keep the Ocean name? Didn't the Ocean name come back for a bit in the early 2000s?
No, they used it for a couple of... There was one game on the PlayStation, B-Tunnel,
God.
B-2 Tunnel.
B-Tunnel. Something like that. It wasn't great.
Yeah. Mission Impossible on the N64. That was published by Ocean, but it was Infograms by that point. You know, it wasn't the same company. They bought it, they used it for, I don't know, 6 months to a year, and then killed it off. Which is a shame, because that logo, yeah, I'd love to see it still being used today. And I think Gary Bracey did try and bring it back, but he couldn't buy the rights to it because Atari own it now. And
okay.
Or someone else does. Bandai own it now, by the looks of it.
Bandai
Namco.
Yeah.
It's sad, though, because someone like Bitmapsoft that we were talking about before, someone who is putting out new 8-bit, 16-bit games, if they owned the Ocean brand now.
Nostalgia.
Little developers that could come to them and like put them stuff out and be, I'm with Ocean. For all of us, we'd just be like,
in the same way that Crash and Zap and, you know, some of these magazines have come back, it'd be great to see a publisher. Now, Ocean, to me, was the biggest publisher in the UK for many years, and it was... I expected quality. I didn't always get it. You know, they released quite a few turkeys, but I think with Ocean, you stood half a chance of getting a decent arcade conversion compared to a lot of other companies.
There was that publisher, wasn't there? Was it Puddle? Oh, they changed their name to Puddle.
That's right, yeah.
They're still going, I think.
Which evoked the... you don't see them as much of these days, sort of around, but I think they are still going, but they used the same kind of font, wasn't it? It definitely evoked
old Ocean. Paid homage to it.
Very good.
Sad to see them go, but I always remember them in the magazines. They're always next to, I think it was the, was it Silica? Was the shop that sold all the computers? That was always like the next page along, and it'd just be like, Amiga package, 300 quid, comes with all this.
I remember seeing the adverts when they was advertising for programmers, and it'd have them next to a Ferrari or something.
Or a hot woman. Hot woman and a Ferrari.
This is what happens if you're Dave Lawson and you run out of all your money. You can drive a Ferrari 1 week, and then you won't have a car the next.
That's it.
So what's some of our favourite games? Should we have a little go round and just rattle off a couple?
Who's going to go first?
I'll throw my first one out there.
Go on, him.
So my first one is Platoon on the C64. And I just remember absolutely loving this game when I first got it. It was one of the first games that, funnily enough, made me feel sad. Like, I'd never had a game
before.
Was it
the music? It was very atmospheric, wasn't it?
Yeah, the music was beautiful. Absolutely wonderful.
David Whittaker, I think, done
it. But it was like a really sad piece of music. Really, really nice. And it had, I can't remember if it was after you just died at the end or at the start. I can't remember the loading screen. But it had silhouettes of soldiers on a hill against a white sky. Like, black silhouette, white sky on a hill.
Yeah.
And that, there it is. That's How good it, is yeah. that? Look at that. That's so good. And yeah, what was that thing it says? The first casualty of war is innocence.
Yeah.
That's quite deep for a 10-year-old. 12-year-old to read.
A lot of these licenses, really, you know, they
Talking from the
they
film.
They weren't really great for kids, were they?
No. But yeah, I just remember booting that up and like this music hit me and I was like, wow. And then I read this, like, you know, as like I say, I must have been 12 or something. The first casualty of war is innocence. And I'm like, God, that's amazing. I don't know what it means. But it's important.
I really want to play that on a C64. I've never got round to it because the Spectrum version, it had great music, but the graphics on it, they was overly detailed. So you couldn't, someone jumped up in front of you, which they did in that game, or come out of bushes. Sounds a bit dodgy. it was game over too quickly. It was very hard to see.
I'll tell you what.
C64 is the definitive version.
I think it is, yeah.
It's really not. I'm just watching it now, and when you go into a building, the front of the building goes kind of opaque. Or it almost looks like it goes opaque. It doesn't. Mm. It disappears. So you can see inside the building, plus all the foreground scenery you walk behind, which just gives an element of depth without any parallax scrolling. I remember having this as a big box game. I don't think I played it that much, though, for some strange reason.
It was quite difficult.
The level of appeal.
Yeah, but once you got to grips with it, it was pretty good. But like your first level, you'd walk through the jungle, and it was kind of like a maze, really.
Mm.
But it was 2D scrolling, or not even scrolling, 2D screen, little bit of scrolling, come down or up into the next part of the jungle. But you had to dodge tripwires, would be one thing you had to dodge. You had to dodge guys just popping up out the ground with a gun and shooting at you. And obviously, occasionally, there'd be another guy out of the army from the enemy who'd walk into the screen, so you had to quickly duck and shoot. So it was quite tough. And you had to find your way around this kind of maze in the jungle to the way out. So it was a little bit tough, but it had a few different sections to the game. And they were all quite different. So you had the 2D mazy bit, and then the second bit was in the tunnels under the... under the ground. Through the water, you're like going through water and that, and it was like a nice 3D effect that they'd done in these tunnels. And you come around the corner, like a guy would pop out the water with a knife, and you have to be fast and shoot him, and that was pretty cool. And then it had a final level was a bit like Grisor again, we were talking about, but another 3D section where you had to like roll to the left and roll to the right and shoot stuff, and then run up to the end and go through. And I think there was another section, but I can't quite remember it. But it was beautifully done. It was difficult, but it was worth it. And like I say, that production level was really high.
Yeah.
Graphics were nice. Music was nice. Gameplay was nice. Fitted with the idea of the film as well.
Yeah. Right. Did you put your Platoon poster up on your wall?
I think I did. I think I probably did. Yeah. It was cool. It was really good.
Mm.
So for me, going back to that now, well, I watched that YouTube today, and even Kim Justice said it's still brilliant. Still a really, really good game. Mm. So, yeah. What about you guys? You played it or liked it or...?
I played the Spectrum version. As I say, it had great music. The graphics were over detailed, you know, and that there was colour, but it's just too difficult to see. So I definitely want to try the C64 version.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, it's a great version. Nice. I played that.
Yeah, cool. I'll chuck one in. I've just thought of it, actually. It's not one that I planned. And another C64 one that really shouldn't have worked, but it really did, was Operation Wolf.
Mm. Yeah.
So I remember going on holiday and playing in the arcade, and obviously you had the cabinet with the gun, which was the most ideal thing for the game. But me and my mate had it on the C64, and do you know what? It worked really well on joystick, and I still go back to that as a home version now. It plays nicely, it's smooth as silk, and it's, again, it's like what Steve said, the production quality is just up there. Beautiful music, loading
that
music as well.
That was a big Christmas release, that, wasn't it?
Was it?
Operation
was
Wolf, yeah.
And having read, I remember reading an interview with a coder in Retro Gamer many years ago, and the way they managed to get the panel along the side.
That's right,
the screen,
I remember reading that.
He's actually kind of overlaying it on top of the scrolling, because you can still see a line of pixels on the far right-hand side. He had to overlay it on top to get it to be able to print alongside the scrolling level. But I think they got the inertia right on the joystick controls with the crosshairs. And it just plays really, really nicely for a game that really shouldn't, because of that gun mechanic.
Yeah.
I don't know whether it was as good on the Speccy, but it was certainly...
I'll tell you something. I think all three 8-bit versions are superb. It works really well on the Spectrum. A little hard to see again at times. The Amstrad version was really nice, very colourful. Same code as the Spectrum, maybe slightly slower because...
No
of
way.
Just a midge.
Get out.
Very, very good and really playable. What's the 16-bit versions like? Did you ever play those?
The Amiga one was decent with a mouse.
You can control with the mouse, yeah.
The mouse somehow doesn't feel as good as the joystick. It's more instant than you expect it to be as good, but it almost feels a bit easy.
Right.
Because you can just point to where you want to shoot. The joystick gave it a little bit of a challenge, and I think that gave the coders a bit of a challenge to make it feel quite good, which they clearly did. Yeah, I remember playing the Amstrad version not so long back, and it is really decent.
It becomes a different game that I can't remember too much about. I'm sure I had it on the specy, but the Amiga version I played a lot. I think I can imagine it becomes a different game with the inertia. They'd have to almost design that, because obviously with the light gun you can just instantly point. With a mouse you can just essentially instantly point. They'd have to change the design, wouldn't they, to make it so that you had a little bit more reaction time.
Yeah. I guess the way that, if they put that kind of thought into it, then the enemy waves would have been more sympathetic to that control mechanic.
I think the 16-bit versions were also done by Ocean France, so it was a different team working on the 16-bit versions. Maybe that's why it feels a little bit different.
Okay.
But a really decent game. It just popped into my head then when Steve was talking about Platoon. It wasn't one of the games I planned to talk about, but it was just a really solid. You know what? You couldn't have expected more on the 8-bits as an arcade conversion. And I, no word of a lie, I come home from the arcades and played it that Sunday on the C64, and I didn't feel that shortchanged. It was balmy. Maybe it's because I couldn't reach the gun because I was so short in the arcade. So I'm kind of peering up. But yeah, decent game. Nice.
Yeah. Cool.
Who's next?
Go on, Mads. Let's go next.
Go on, Mads.
I already mentioned, for me, Ocean is primarily the arcade conversions that I played on my Amiga. I mean, those are that pop into my mind immediately. I think probably between Pang, Rainbow Islands, and New Zealand Story, that would cover maybe 40% of the time I spent with my Amiga, because those are some games I put so many hours into, and I just love them. And they were all published by Ocean, at least. But speaking of some of their own developments, I mean, for some reason, I used to play Terminator 2 a lot. And it's actually a really, really bad game. I don't know if you guys played it.
Yeah, I played it.
Yet another one of these collections of minigames like their Batman the Movie game. And actually, Batman the Movie and the Terminator game has something in common. That's the way they measure your health in Terminator. Face. It's the face that switches from one state to another. So you switch from Arnie's face to the T-1000, I guess. Or maybe just Arnie's skeleton, I guess. Arnie's skeleton. The skeleton head.
Yeah, the exoskeleton.
And the Batman, you switch from Batman to the Joker, of course.
That's right,
It's not a very good game, but it starts, I don't know, it ties into a franchise I liked, and I was far too young to be watching those movies, but I did. So I really liked the Terminator movies, and you got to fight. The first scene is you fighting as Arnie fighting the T-1000. And I still to this day, I just played it today, still to this day, actually don't really know how you do that. I mean, I can win the fight, barely. But there's no strategy for me at all. It's just mashing buttons. Yeah. And then when you're done with that fight, you go out on the bike. And you know, if you remember the scene from the movie as well, you've got
chased by the lorry.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to avoid the lorry. And I don't know. It's actually not a very good game. And
it's not. I had high hopes for that when it was being previewed, because Terminator 2 was such a big hit, and this looks great in screenshots.
It
was such a letdown.
and each little minigame in itself could have been good if they just tweaked the gameplay mechanics a bit. I mean, they look good and they move good already. I mean,
they're usually over very quickly. You can, the fighting sections in, you can do it within a minute or so.
But it's the weirdest thing with nostalgia. I still enjoy playing T2. I like just turning it on, and I'll never ever get off the second stage these days. I don't even remember what the third one is right now. So, but it's one of my
the puzzle you had to like fix his wrist.
Yeah, that's true.
Moving the blocks around.
That's
fixing the wiring in his hand. That's true.
Yeah.
So the C64 game looks slightly different. It's more platform shoot 'em up. With a couple of mini games rather than all the mini games, from what I can see.
I think the Amiga version does have a shoot 'em up level. I had it on the Spectrum, 1 to 8K only. It took about 15 minutes to load, and it was a cut down version, even in 1 to 8K. You know, the beat 'em up section was just one single screen, didn't scroll left to right at all. the section where you're on the bike being chased by the lorry, it looked like a game from 1985. You know, graphically, it was really a good step back. It was awful. I was so disappointed in that.
What year did it come out, Mads, for the 16 bits?
91, was it?
Yeah, I think it's quite a late one. 91, yeah.
So on the 64, I think it was a cartridge-only game. That's right, it was just when the GS had come out, so that would have been 91 or 92, and it was one of the ones where it was just cartridge, and Ocean did a big thing with a lot of carts. There was SCI Chase HQ2, which was quite good. That, which was quite good. Shadow of the Beast, I think, was another one that they did. A couple of others before all the cartridges dried up again. They go for big bucks on eBay now. Massive money.
It's a poor effort, given they'd had produced very many good games by then, isn't it?
That game wasn't actually produced in-house. That was done by a team called Dementia. They'd done the Golden X conversions on the Amiga, which was a really good conversion.
Yeah, it was.
Terrible name.
Yeah, a bit of a strange name. Yeah. I don't think they've done much else, but yeah, Terminator 2 was a proper turkey.
Definitely.
Yeah, so that was a great choice by me, eh?
Yeah, well done. Something to talk about.
You've highlighted something like there, Mads.
I can't defend it, but I still like it.
You've highlighted something there, though, Mads, which is Ocean had a bad habit of a lot of their games had to be broken into these mini games now. This is how we do it. We have a racing level.
Didn't it? You know, RoboCop 1, I think, works really well. Batman the movie, sort of. Pretty well.
There was that puzzle bit where you were like, what do we do?
No one knew how to do that. That was the thing. I could do the first level, and then you went on to that, and I didn't have a clue.
Yeah, exactly.
I had to use a cheat mode.
Yeah, same.
Well, I'm going to talk about one in a sec, the way that I think it did work really well, that by-the-numbers approach. But the first game I'm going to mention didn't do that, did something which was a bit more continuous, and that's Navy SEALs.
Amiga or 64.
Well, I'm going to talk about the Amiga version, but it did come out on all the 8 bits,
pretty much everything.
And the 16 bits, and the Game Boy, which I didn't realise there was a Game Boy port to it. But it was a 1990 game, so for the 8 bits, you know, reasonably late, smack bang in the lifespan of the Amiga. I was very intrigued. Firstly, I thought we were just talking about licensed games, and I chose Navy SEALs, and I thought, no, I can't have Navy SEALs because it's not a licensed game. It is licensed.
I've never seen the film.
Apparently, the film's crap.
Yeah, I should imagine.
I've seen that, definitely, back in the day.
Apparently, it's really bad. But see, I was going to pick Blues Brothers I thought because it's a licensed game, I just assumed it would have been Ocean, but it wasn't. Anyway, back to Navy SEALs. So I think that the setup is, I don't think it's got a huge amount of story. I don't know anything about the film, but throughout the levels, there are scattered around these missiles that you have to find. So you have to find these Stinger missiles on each level, make it to the exit. If you imagine a much slower, way more difficult, not as good Rolling Thunder, kind of somewhere in the right area of what the game is.
I like it though.
I was so intrigued by this game because it was so blooming hard that I always
find that there's too many frames of animation when, like, you're climbing up and stuff.
You can't move.
It's too slow to respond. That's what I'm saying. So you get caught in this cycle of animation, you can't do anything.
But I have read a couple of back in the day reviews of Navy SEALs, and what it says is it is so incredibly difficult. But if you can get over that initial hump, and you can get used to the way it moves, as Dina said, I think the animation cycles are such that you almost have to anticipate that someone's going to shoot and start crouching before the shot comes. Once you get into that rhythm, apparently it is quite playable.
It is. I wouldn't say I got far on it, but I certainly got past the first level. it's good.
There's a timer counting down as well, isn't there? And every time you find a set of Stinger missiles, the timer moves. And there is a lot. You know, I had this image of role-playing, you know, this commando going into these bases. When I was younger, I was so intrigued by that. I just couldn't do it. I actually fired up the ST version earlier today, just to give it, because I've got the SD Dungeon Master.
Flip screen, is it?
Sorry?
Flip screen, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I love
that. Yeah, well, do you know what? I can't
I
actually
don't
remember.
Think it is.
No, it's not.
I think
no,
it scrolls.
No, it does scroll. And in fact, it, from what I can remember, it scrolls just as well as the Amiga, to be honest. I mean, it's not a very fast game anyway. Right.
It might be an ST port on the Amiga, Steve.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
Yeah, I don't think so, because it was way later for all that nonsense.
Don't know. I wouldn't be so sure.
But anyway, it is still incredibly difficult, and I didn't have any patience for it today and very quickly switched it off. But as a, again, as a nostalgia piece, when I think of Ocean, one of the games that first comes to mind is Navy SEALs. So, yeah, if anybody wants to be masochistic and play a game which actually isn't very good and is very difficult, play Navy SEALs.
You know, or maybe just watch the movie.
Or just watch the movie and torture yourself even more.
Funny thing about how the mind works, immediately when you said Navy SEALs, I started humming The Boys Are Back in Town by Thin Lizzy, because that's used in that movie. I just remember a scene from that movie where they're walking into this Middle Eastern town, I guess, where they need to kill somebody who's got some hostages. I can't remember because I watched this movie once in my life, but The Boys Are Back in Town is definitely there.
Good recall.
Total recall.
Yeah.
Was one of this.
Yeah, exactly. Go on, Dean, what you got?
I'm going to go with RoboCop.
Got to.
A bit predictable, but it was on the Spectrum. It was number one for about 18 months. I think they just got the atmosphere. They translated that film to a game on the Spectrum so well. Great music on the 128K machines. It had speech from the film. The levels, this is what I was saying. Yeah, with RoboCop, it really works. It wasn't based on the arcade game as such. Levels, the first level, you know, you're walking along the streets, very similar to the arcade. And then you move on to the alleyway where you're shooting the rapist and you're trying to save the girl. Then it's another street level. You complete that and then you've got a photo ID section. Mm. Again, straight from the film. Then it's, I think you're going for a junkyard on the next level.
Mm.
And then you get into the OCP tower, work your way up. Actually, I've missed a few levels. There's a drugs level, drugs factory level. But it just followed the film very, very closely, and it ends with Dick Jones holding Guy OCP hostage, and you shoot him, it's game over, and it just goes round again. But, yeah, it was just a fantastic film conversion. I remember getting the demo with Crash Magazine for the Spectrum. It was slightly different to the final game. You could actually, if you fired at the bad guys that were above you, they'd fall down. And if you carried on shooting, you could make their bodies bounce on the bullets, like ricochet.
Nice.
And that feature wasn't in the final game. I was kind of gutted about it. But everything about it was class. The music, the animation, the graphics, the playability. A lot of people moans that it was too hard. I found it a bit too easy. You know, when RoboCop gets shot, he gets stunned. And if it is a bit of a memory test game, you know, you've got to play it a few times and know where the enemy are going to pop out.
Yeah,
just a superb version. I know it's not like that across the board. The C64 had fantastic music. Game couldn't be completed when it was released. Yeah, the graphics were corrupt on one of the levels you couldn't walk through. The Amstrad version was great. 16-bit versions followed the arcade a little bit more, and they weren't as hot as what they could have been. But I found it a fantastic game, very playable.
Yeah, it was. I mean, obviously, the music kind of speaks for itself.
Yeah, and the Game Boy version, which obviously, you know, the music went on the Ariston advert, on and on. yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he's one of those classic games. You'll always look back and, yeah, you look back on it for the music, but it was a really, really nice game. And I always liked his animation when he's walking up the stairs.
Yeah.
There was something about it that went, ooh, you know, that was really tidy. And then obviously the game scrolled to a different area. I found the difficulty level really quite nice on it for someone like myself. And I think, yeah that getting stunned is what you need to take care of.
You just got to try and avoid getting stunned.
Just nice game.
I think of all the games that we're talking about tonight, there's not many of them that you could go back to and instantly pick it up and start enjoying them. I think there is enjoyment there in all of them somewhere, but RoboCop actually is one of those that you can, even now today, Specky version at least, go and...
Specky and Amstrad, you know, this ain't 8-bit wars. The Amstrad version's very good as well.
Yeah, but you can go, you can fire it up right now, and you'd be enjoying yourself straight away. It's very playable right from the off.
Yeah.
Nice. Let's go around. Steve, you're next. You were first.
Am I next again? Other game is Whizball. Now, not strictly made by Ocean, because it's really a sensible software game.
Yeah.
But it was put out by Ocean. And this has the plaudit of being one of the greatest C64 games of all time. Regularly comes number one for the greatest C64 game. I remember getting this on the Commodore 64, and it was just an amazing game. Like, you started off with this cool sound effects, and then you had a crazy guitar solo thing at the end, and smashed noise, like smashing glass when you died, and crazy bonkers idea of you're a wizard inside a ball bouncing up and down. And you've got to basically collect your power-ups so that you stop bouncing and you can fly and then you can shoot stuff. And the idea is to basically colour in all the levels by using your catalyte, which is your little cat inside his own little ball, to shoot aliens and collect the paint drops that they colour. They drop. And then once you've got all your colours, you basically go to his little place and fill all the cauldrons up with colour. And then paint the levels, and eventually when you did it all properly, all the levels would be coloured in properly instead of black and white, which I never managed to do. But just an absolutely bonkers idea, executed perfectly, and became something practically unique. And it's like, it's another one of these things where, like, it's better than the Amiga version. It's way better than the Amiga version, and it shouldn't be, but it is.
Lead platform.
So, but you would think, oh, we've got parallax scrolling on the Amiga now, and Bethmore sprite handling and everything, just nowhere near
didn't
as good.
Have the same feel.
No.
Yeah, it's kind of the charm of the 8-bit there, that where it was better than the Amiga version.
Who programmed the 16-bit version? Was it sensible, or
not too sure if they farmed it out?
I've got to say, as a Specky owner, I played Whizball, and I'd seen the reviews for the C64 version. And when I played the Spectrum version, I thought, what is all the fuss about? This is rubbish. And it's one of those games, you know, because of the sound effects and the way it all moves, the C64 was the perfect platform for it. It didn't work on the Spectrum anyway. I don't think there is an Amstrad version of Whizball. I might be wrong, but it certainly didn't work on the Specky.
Because Ocean published WizKid as well, didn't they? The sequel.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which sold appallingly, apparently.
It's a strange game.
Whizball was really good, actually. Yeah. And like WizKid was really good, actually.
Yeah, well, we almost had it, didn't we, for our sensible software.
That's true.
Wasn't a sensible software. Ended up almost like a sensible software game club, didn't we, a few months ago when Matt was on. But I can't remember the story of why Ocean didn't publish the first sensible soccer. I think sensible software had a falling out with them, didn't they?
Yeah,
about royalties.
On WizKid, I think it was royalties and WizKid.
Yeah,
I think I heard the other day they didn't make much money out of Whizball either. Like, considering
the non-licensed Ocean games didn't sell well as what you'd think they would. Yeah, I'd still like Head Over Heels didn't sell anywhere near as much as what Batman did. It's really a sequel to Batman, the 3D game by John Rickman, but. Yeah, unfortunately, it was the licenses that was selling, you know.
Nice game. I've always found it really frustrating, but I know how good it is. It's never clicking me. It's like patting your head and rubbing your belly. It feels like that to me because you're spinning and bouncing, and
it is
just
damn hard in the beginning.
I'm sure it pays off.
I feel a lot of people struggle with any game where you're just bouncing around trying to control something like that.
Yeah.
Anyone who's worth their salt and talks about Whizball always says, "No, you've got to kind of stick with it to break the back of the controls." And once you do, it all clicks together.
Paul Monahan.
Is that what he says?
It. Paul Monahan knows, so Paul Monahan did it. I keep telling him off. I've told him off on another podcast recently about this. Daz asked me to do a little clip about C64 games for his show, and I just did a little clip talking about Wizbob and told Paul Monahan off, which is basically Paul Monahan did the top rated C64 games on Maximum Power Up a few years ago and found that Wizbob was the top one, and he just slated it. He was like, it's absolutely crap. You can't control the ball. I don't know what you're supposed to do. You just bounce all over the place. It's like some stupid pinball thing. And then you can't do anything. And then you crash into the bad guys and you die. I don't know what all the fuss is about.
Sounds like Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah. And I messaged him when I heard the episode and I bollocked him. I was like, what are you talking about, you clown? This is the best game ever. Yeah. He's not a clown. I'll take that back. He's a nice guy. But yeah, it's like you've got to get the first two power-ups to get into the game. So the first one stops you bouncing all over the place, and the second one lets you fly. And then once you get those two, you're good to go there. It's basically shoot them up after that. But yeah, great game, amazing game.
Mm. Nice. Well, I'll stick with another sensible game, Parallax on the C64.
Nice.
Which, sensible software.
Yep.
I got a word. Sensible software. I think this was 86 from memory. I'm working from memory here. Just a beautiful game. Again, Martin Galway, I think he'd started working with Sensible by this point. What a theme tune. Esoteric as hell, you know. It's a bit of a noise, but it's a really, really nice noise. Great in-game music as well. But it's a shoot 'em up at heart, but you've got to crack a central computer. And to do that, you need to go and find some scientists, kill them, get a code from that particular scientist, get back in your ship and find another scientist and rinse and repeat and all that sort of stuff. Then you've got a drugger scientist at the end to help him crack the code of the central computer. But in and around that, just this beautiful, weird, again, esoteric world of oddball enemies that come after you when you're on the ground, because you can get out of your ship and walk to little bunkers where hopefully the scientists are. And being its game Parallax, beautiful Parallax scroll, and you can fly under the deck as well. And I think there's hyperspace things on the deck as well where you can fly into them and they take, or teleportation holes that teleport you to different parts of the land. I've never played it enough to get very far because it's really, really difficult. Apparently you've got some colleagues you need to find as well, and it's clearly never got that far. But it's a great shoot 'em up, it's a great concept of a game. And it's just so atmospheric at the same time. The on-ground music just kind of takes you somewhere, even though it's not atmospheric in and of itself. It just does something. It's got a kind of melancholy feel to it. But just class, like Wizball by Sensible. It's just class. And it's a game that wouldn't work on any other platform. In fact, it wasn't released, was it, on anything else? So, yeah, just a beautiful game by Sensible. And yeah, it feels a bit strange calling it an ocean game because it feels just like pure Sensible, a bit like Wizball as well. It's just a pure Sensible game. If they were publishing games at the time, they'd have published that.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think it got given away free on Zap in the end.
Yeah, well, that happened, didn't it, with a lot of the magazines in the later life. You know, those getting full price releases on them.
But Zap did a big feature on it on that. Not 86, it might have been 88 actually. It could even be 89. God knows.
87, I think. 87,
good. But it was one of those years. You know, somewhere.
Yeah, 86 or 87.
The cover of Zap for that issue was lovely. It was January of whatever year it came out. Maybe they just had a demo on there. But yeah, I think it's a game you could go back on because it's got so much depth in that you've got to crack this code. But it's not just a matter of shooting the odd scientist. You've got to find scientists that have got the code to help you to crack it. Plus, you've got to shoot them up in there. Plus, you've got to find these other colleagues of yours or something like that, which I didn't know you had to do. So there's a really deep game in there. And I highly recommend everyone goes back and plays it because it is really, really good and slick. And spend 13 minutes listening to the title tune as well.
Yeah, I'll second that. It is a great game. And it's got, as you said, more depth than you actually just see on the surface there. And it's somehow has a great feeling of place. I mean, it feels like a real world that you're flying around in. Just the fact that you can fly around and you can put your ship down, then you can walk out of your ship and go into these bases. It feels like you're actually there in this virtual world. So to me, it feels somewhat like playing Exile, for example. just a better version, a more fun version of Exile. So yeah, definitely recommend that.
I've never played it. Yeah, sounds like you should check it out though.
I'll have to try that.
Yeah,
I like it.
It gave the difficulty curve because it is really difficult. Because you know the enemies can get you on land or in the ship, and parts of the world I think you can only get to if you fly under the surface, and flying under the surface poses its own challenges because you can't see much of the ship. So it's but it's unique. It's a very unique game actually.
Yeah,
nice.
Cool.
That's me.
Who's next?
Mads, I think.
So I already gave my second game away because that was Batman the movie, and we already talked about that. But there are so many great games here. Let's talk about the Addams Family. So let you guys play the classic Addams Family Euro platformer.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I played it on the Amiga. Yeah. It's quite different on the 8-bits, the Spectrum version. It got rave reviews. It was
A
very difficult game, though. Totally different to the Amiga version.
So I actually never played it on anything but the Amiga. So that's the one I know from back in the day. And I remember really enjoying it back in the day, and I played it today as well. It does suffer from Europlatformer, the disease called Europlatformer. But apart from that, it's still really playable.
I think it's one of the better Europlatformers.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those that actually had a button
on the
SNES
as well, which is a nice version. It's like an enhanced version.
The Mega Drive, I think, is the best version of it. If you want to play
it. Was it released on the Mega Drive?
Yeah. It was a really, really good. I'm sure it was.
The SNES version's lovely.
Maybe it is the SNES I'm thinking of, but yeah. Just it had the parallax scrolling, which made it feel more of a world than the Amiga version.
Yeah.
But the Amiga version is still a really solid platform. In fact, there's a version going around somewhere that's got my name on the cracking screen.
How would that happen, Matt?
I don't know. I hacked the crack.
Hacked the crack.
Yeah, I remember that story.
Story of your life, that man.
Yeah, isn't it, mate? Yeah. Tell me about it.
But it's still a good game, and a game that you can pick up today if you want to dive into your platform.
Yeah, it's easy to get into, isn't it?
It's well built.
Yeah, it's got this. It's got the nice classic Addams Family theme tune running along there, and just exactly.
It has the feel of Super Mario World, I think, in a way. It's less Sonic-y and more Super Mario World, but it's just got something about it.
The pacing is definitely more Super Mario World than not Sonic, and you jump on the heads of enemies to kill them, so there's some similarity there. And I like the fact that it's a button to jump and not up to jump in this game.
Yes.
So that makes it a bit more playable as well. And it's like RoboCop, for example, James Bond 2, you enter all of these different worlds by entering doors, so you can there's a huge mansion to explore there and lots of stuff to get through.
Yeah. I think it's better than RoboCop. I don't like RoboCop particularly these days, but I think it's better game than that. It's more fun, it's more fluid.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a Mega Drive version, just checked on YouTube. And I think they are slightly more definitive than the Amiga version just because that parallax scrolling does add a bunch to the gameplay. Yeah.
Right, who's next?
I'll go. So my second game, just before I dive into that, a couple of honourable mentions. We've not mentioned Match Day.
John Ritman's Match Day series,
which...
Match Point as well.
One of my absolute favourites. I loved Match Day.
Match Day 2, Chris?
I absolutely loved both of them. That and Emlyn Hughes on the Speccy were
Emlyn Hughes on the Spectrum is very underrated. It's a great football
and
game.
And on the Amiga. I mean, that's not Ocean.
That's not by Ocean.
No, it's not. But those were Match Day and Emlyn were my go-to footy games. And Daily Thompson. Have we mentioned Daily Thompson's The Catalyst?
No, we haven't. That's a great game.
So, the start of it.
Yeah, you're right.
That was, again, one of my absolute go-tos on the Spectrum. Daily Thompson's The Catalyst. Absolutely loved it.
It's the joystick killer.
Amazing cover by Bob Wakelin on Daily Thompson. Mm. Absolutely superb. But the game I wanted to talk about was Untouchables.
Special effects.
So not one developed by Ocean, but published by Ocean in 1990 or 89, 90, I think.
89,
the
I
darkest
think.
Game palette known to man, I think, as well.
What, for Untouchables?
Yeah, it's so dark.
It is a bit. It's not, but you know what? The graphics are really nice. On the Amiga, anyway. The graphics are...
They're good on all of the versions, I think.
But
nice
that was the one
game.
Thing that I based it on really what I've got nostalgia for, and then I've done a little bit of. Didn't actually manage to play this one, but I've been reading a few of the reviews. from back in the day. And even looking at the screenshots now, I mean, I don't know, I can't remember what it was like when it was moving, but it instills, it looks really, really nice now for a game of its age.
See, I liked certain sections of it. There was a bit where you was hiding around the corner of a building with a
yeah,
shotgun.
Yeah, that was the...
And you leant out and...
That was in the alleyway, wasn't it?
That's right,
yeah.
Yeah.
That was the
those sections I really level. Liked. And that was quite gory, if I remember
right. Well, it's got the level with the pram.
Yeah.
From, you know, that scene from the fence. And it's like... Like RoboCop, it actually sticks to the plot of the film
really well.
And the scenes of the game follow the scenes of the film. Obviously not as many because I think there's only five or six levels, but it's got that scene from an overhead view where you've
that's
got to
right,
shoot
yeah.
the baddies.
It's going down the stairs.
Yeah.
And,
it's really good. This you know, from recollection, and actually it got really well reviewed at the time. This is an example of where Ocean's by the numbers approach to the film licenses that we've seen with Batman, we've seen with RoboCop. It's actually an example of where it works. And if they can get decent variety in those mini game slash styles of levels, actually they can create something which is greater than the sum of its parts. Because I think if you had one of these levels as a game in and of itself, probably wouldn't be great.
It wouldn't hold up at all. You're
but if
right.
you mash it
yeah.
all together, my only recollection, and this was borne out from a couple of the reviews I read, level one just seemed to go on forever and ever. And it became really difficult just because you had to find these pieces of paper. The baddies were carrying around this evidence that you had to find. And only some of them dropped it. So you had to just keep shooting. By the time you finished, I think you've probably murdered about 500,000 baddies. And you have to find sort of 6 or 7 scraps of evidence. So you just keep going and going and going until you find them. So, yeah, I mean, maybe it could have been designed a little bit better, but as you get into it and some of these other levels, again, it kind of game where it keeps you going, wanting to see what comes next. And I'm from what I've read in the magazines, a few magazines I've read today, actually, it seems like it would still hold up today. So I'm glad that was one of them that came to mind. So, probably one for us to go back and try.
Cool.
Nice.
Right, well, I'm going to cheat a bit here because... my next game is actually published on the Imagine label, but they were owned by Ocean. It was an Ocean development team who'd done this, and it's Target Renegade, which was released on the free 8-bit machine, C64, Amstrad, and ZX Spectrum. The C64 version has the most fantastic music. I absolutely love it, and I often just load the game up to listen to the music, and I'm sure a lot of Ocean games were loaded up just to listen to the music sometimes.
Oh yeah.
Doesn't play as well on a C64. Really nice game graphically though. Very different look to the other two versions. Basically, Ocean went for the Double Dragon license and didn't get it. So that's when they come up with Target Renegade. They had already converted the original Renegades in 1987. So some software houses started doing this. They done their own unofficial sequel.
It's one of the strange things about the terms of the license. I mean, they did it, TierTex did it with Strider as well, didn't they? Created a Strider too. And
it's
funny
strange.
Little quirk.
The game was also released on the NES a few years later, and that had the Taito license. So Taito had obviously contacted them by
so
this
point. Reverse license there.
Yeah, it's a bit strange. But on the Speccy and Amstrad, it is a simultaneous two-player beat-em-up. Doesn't actually scroll, it's flip-screen. 5 levels, start off in a car park. The story is that your brother, who's a journalist, has been investigating these gangsters, he's been murdered, and you're going out for revenge. So, very simple, but really nice game to play. Yeah, especially on the Amstrad and Speccy. Really worth checking out.
Second level in the subway, Dean. Do you go down into the subway?
No. You start off in the car park. Second level is in the streets. That's with the prostitutes and the pimp with the gun. Third level is a park.
Yeah.
Next level is a shopping precinct. And then you're in a pub where you take out the final bad guy.
Nice. Yeah.
So, yeah, really good game. Really enjoyable. Not so much on the C64, but the music kind of makes up for it.
Yeah. Very nice.
Mm.
Tidy. Anyone else got a game?
I
I think we've all been around a couple of times. I've got one more.
Yeah, so this is one where this is another really average film, I think, or terrible film, but actually a really nice game. Hudson Hawk on the Amiga.
I knew you was going to say that. Hmm.
So I know nothing about the film other than I think it was shocking, wasn't it? Was it? I only saw it once.
Bruce Willis.
Bruce Willis. I wanted the film was all right.
That was it. But the game, having replayed it this weekend, is really nice. So it's platformer, like a lot of these games. But it's got some really nice little gameplay mechanics. But I'll say straight off, the graphics on the Amiga are brilliant. They are almost indie game good of nowadays. So this is a special effects game, so it was the graphics artist, what was it, Karen, what was her name? Whatever her name was. Yeah, Karen Davies. So a special effects game, and the graphics, I think they're up there with a retro, an indie game of nowadays. The control mechanic, a bit like Untouchables, a bit like Navis, is a little bit slow, but it's still very, very playable. But it's got some really nice little mechanics in there, like there's some CCTV cameras that can flash you, which stun you. There's a paparazzi bloke that chases you around, and if he's managed to catch a picture of you, one, it takes a picture and shows you a little instant photo of you in black and white on the screen, which is a lovely touch, but you lose energy with that. But if you get it to punch him first, his trousers fall down, he doesn't get a picture of you, and then he falls off the screen. There's just a couple of nice little things like that, and loads of different enemies as you work through the levels. I just think it's a great little platform, actually. It got rated fairly well back in the day, sort of 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
But going back to it now, I think it stands up really, really nicely in light of a very average license, which I'm sure didn't sell that well because it was a pretty average film from what I remember. Mm. I think it's got a few little standout things in it that really make it stand up nowadays. So, I reckon have a play with it. It's a really good little game. I don't know what it converted like to the C64 and so on.
I only played the Amiga and the Speccy versions. It's slightly different on the Spectrum. I think some of the levels are a little bit cut down, but it played pretty well.
See, I remembered it in my head more like Blues Brothers and Titus the Fox on the Amiga, so they're more fast-paced.
Quite slow, isn't it? It's animation.
But it's more unique because of it. I don't think it's frustrating. Once you get used to that speed, it is. It's better than Blues Brothers and Titus the Fox, I think. Mm. Definitely.
Yeah. I think you're probably right that game suffered from the film not being so popular because that's how they sold these games, of course. They're licensed games.
Yeah.
I remember actually getting a copy of this because the store was throwing them away at some point.
Really?
So I was that annoying little kid that was always in the store, so they knew me in there. So when I went in there one day,
he might go away.
Yeah, exactly. They gave me that and I was off. So I actually had a copy of that, but I didn't play it a lot myself. So maybe I should try it again.
It's a nice little game.
Yeah. Mm,
it really is. It really is. Mm. I'm surprised going back to it, actually.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Quite average, but it's good.
Yeah, very good.
Okay.
Got any others?
Well, Pang, some good arcade conversions. Pang on the Amiga was great. Yes. I nearly included that as my game, but there's not a lot you can say about Pang. It's Pang and it's good.
I played that today. It's still just as addictive as it was back in the day. It's a brilliant game.
Yeah.
It's a really good conversion. It's one of
those games you load up, you think, I'll have a quick go, and then half hour later, you're still playing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's an incredible concept and incredible design, and the best thing you can say about it is that they didn't muck it up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it feels just like the arcade version for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Arc Developments with Pang. They've done a good job.
By the way, Hudson Hawk was done by similar people to Apidia on the Amiga. I think a coder and the graphics artist did Apidia.
Nice.
Really? I didn't realise that.
A lot of platform games, wasn't there, throughout their time? A lot of platform games.
Wasn't Hudson Hawk special effects?
I thought it was special effects.
Absolutely. Oh,
they had a good track record then, because they did a great job with Untouchables, I've just mentioned.
Yeah, I think one of their big mistakes was Red Heat.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a shame. That was a real duffer. Which was quite rare, you know. Yeah, proper turkey. The other game I was going to mention was Midnight Resistance. Again, special effects.
Yeah.
Really nice conversion on the Spectrum, thanks to Jim Bagley.
Yeah.
Lovely music. I think it's Keith Timman who done the music on that.
It's a wonderful version on the Mega Drive as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't do the Mega Drive version.
Oh, they didn't? Okay.
No, it's Data East themselves. Okay. I quite like the Amiga version, but it's one of those games where the graphics, there's a hacked version where the graphics have been brightened up. I don't know.
They look washed out, don't they?
Okay.
Yeah, very dark.
Mm.
Yeah, looks washed out.
So I don't know if it's something to do with it being an ST port. Might have been. But.
Mm.
Did you have any more, Steve? Do you have another one?
No, the only thing that was popping into my head, which was just beach volleyball for some reason.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they've done that. I used to like that. Ocean France.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't even that good. I've been back to it recently, and it's like not that good, really. But I did remember really enjoying it at the time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, quirky little game, and one that wasn't really a license of anything.
Yeah.
Go on, Dean.
I was going to just quickly mention a Game Boy game. It's another film license, Dark
Man. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, I've played that.
If, if you've played it on the Game Boy, it's like a follow-up to Target Renegade. Okay. So if you, it's a scrolling beat-em-up.
Yeah.
It's by Mike Lamb. So RoboCop, Target Renegade, and this are all by the same programmer. And it works quite well. And the music, which is by Jonathan Dunn, is especially the, I think it's the first level's music, is really catchy. Good. Really catchy.
Just wanted to mention, they broke Digital Image Designs as well, didn't they? Who did originally F-29 Retaliator, Flight Sim,
RoboCop 3,
Epic, and then RoboCop 3.
Yeah, and then Inferno as well, didn't they? Did they do Inferno as well?
I think, and then the infamous TFX, which never come out on the Amiga, but then come out on the PC.
And it's really good on the PC as well.
I've always wanted to play it because it was hyped up so much on the Amiga.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was going to be slow as hell. But yeah, I think that I'd really like to play the PC version.
Yeah,
that was good. And they've gone on to make professional flight sims for air companies.
Like simulators?
It's proper simulators, yeah. So that they broke them through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So did any of you guys actually play the puzzle game Pushover as well?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Did.
Ocean published that as well. I used to love trying to figure those later levels out on my Amiga.
Yeah. I had a soft spot for that and Sleepwalker as well.
Yeah. Just going to mention Sleepwalker.
Yeah, that's a good one as well.
I think it came with my A1200.
Yeah.
I would always get so frustrated after a while with Sleepwalker.
Yeah.
Oh, it's massively frustrating.
Yeah. It's not a great game, but it was all the proceeds went to Comic Relief, didn't they? Remember?
That's right. Yeah.
94 or 94.
It was a great looking game.
Yeah.
It was. So it was a 1200 and a normal one. It was one of these sort of earlier 1200 games where it looks really, really nice.
Nice copper effects in the in the background.
Parallax
sky.
And copper effects. Yeah. So it looked really, really nice.
A proper turkey that I wanted to mention. And this was a game that I hankered over for months in the magazines. So I was an Amiga owner and a massive WWF fan. So therefore, you had nothing, no wrestling games at all to play. WWF WrestleMania was plastered all over the magazines. And I remember I'd open the magazine and just stare at it, waiting for my mum and dad to say, "What's that you're looking at it?" And I'd be like, "It's WrestleMania. I really want it. Can you send off for it for me?" And in the end, my dad actually did. He went, I sent off, bought the box version. I was so excited. It is absolutely...
Yeah.
I'll tell you what a good version is. I don't know whether it's by Ocean, but it's the Game Boy. And it was Link Up as well.
Yeah, not sure.
That was really good on the Game Boy.
The consoles had some great wrestling games back in those early 16-bit days, and we on the Amiga had nothing, and that was absolute crud.
They did bring out another WWF game, Ocean.
It was after...
It was really smaller graphics.
Yeah, I think that one was better.
I think that was... Yeah, slightly, but not much.
Rampage.
I mean, the original WrestleMania, 1989 or whatever it was unplayable. Terrible.
Ironically, the coder did Alfred Chicken, which is a quite a nice little game.
I don't like that game, so that speaks volumes.
You need to actually try that, Chris. It's a puzzle game at heart. It's really good.
Everything's a puzzle game, as we know that.
Yes, exactly.
Right, well, just want to say thanks again to our listeners.
You're all awesome.
I haven't got a Patreon list ready, I'm afraid, so let's wait to the next episode.
Thank you to all our Patreons.
Yes. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with
us
and giving us the support we've needed. It's really, really appreciated. And it's been overwhelming, really. So thank you.
Class. They're class.
Here's to the future.
Yeah.
Yes.
Onwards and upwards.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
9-bit wars.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Cool. Until next time, everyone, take care.
Take care, everyone.
See you guys.
Bye.
See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.